You're listening to RIA Radio, the nationally trusted name in real estate investing. We dig deep to discover investors' why in real estate. If you want to skip all the BS and get in investors' heads, you're in the right spot. Be one of the thousands to check out RIAradio.com.
So we had just had Justin on. We met Justin originally at Bigger Pockets Conference back in 2021 when it was in New Orleans. And Justin is one of the few people that we got to meet every single year at BPCon. So we were running 3 years strong. One fun thing about Justin is that when I ran into Justin at the last Orlando edition, I'm like, and I was talking to him like we had him on the podcast, but we haven't had him on the podcast yet. He did refer us Martin Krimmel. If you haven't checked him out, we'll put him in the show notes. But Justin, I mean, he is killing it out there. I mean, he's got 110 units. He's spread between three states. Locally, he's doing Des Moines. He's in Detroit and Seattle. Was there anywhere else?
Seattle, Milwaukee. Des Moines, and Detroit. All right, Justin Cambra, man, what a well-rounded investor he is.
Yeah.
He has done, I think this might be the first guy we've had on or investor we've had on that's done Turo as an investment.
Well, Foley's were doing that. We talked to Andrew Foley, they were doing that in Colorado.
If you hadn't interrupted, I was going to say, except for my business partner, Andrea Foley, Axel Foley.
Who's the person that had the jet? In the first 10 episodes. Was it Michael Conway?
Conway.
He also was another person that was doing Turo. It's been very far between.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Look at that memory.
Yeah. Yeah. Steel trap you are.
I know.
But no, Justin,
thanks for recognizing
that. This is really cool because he's invested in multiple different real estate markets, and some of them are like appreciation plays, which he lives in a high cost of living area. So this will be interesting if you're tuning into this and you live outside of the Midwest where maybe it's going to cost you a lot more to buy something and it doesn't cash flow. That's like maybe a foreign language to wherever you're living. But he has supplemented basically his backyard. So he's bought some assets there and banking on appreciation. And he's augmented that with buying stuff in the Midwest, which has provided cash flow. So he's, you know, maybe you're buying something in a, you know, they call it HCOL, high cost of living area. You're not able to make it cash flow, but you can offset that by purchasing something in an area that does. So it's almost kind of like doubling down, but doing it in a diversified way so that you're able to, you know, cover your costs, capitalize on the appreciation that you might not get in a Midwest market. So it's been really cool. And he's like an opportunist. So he looks at, okay, here's the cards that I'm dealt. Here's what's upcoming in the near future, 2 years, 5 years out. I really like what he talked about when it came to the commercial debt that he's taking on. And he's keeping, you know, really close eye on interest rates and when they're going to reset and what he's going to do to, like, basically, you know, combat that in his own personal portfolio. You don't hear a lot of talk about that. People planning ahead based on the debt service that they're going to have to, you know, continue to pay for if they want to hold on to an asset.
Yeah. So he's going to get into hard money. He's going to get into his new strategy, which is subject to financing, which is the big Pace Morby way. And just, you know, getting creative and not using banks. So kind of expect that in today's episode.
Exactamundo.
So last time we got chit-chatting a little bit, you were kind of dealing with some stuff with your commercial unit that had the flooding issue. Any progress to that?
So, okay. Yesterday, I met one of my business partners there that we own this property together. We met the restoration company. So we have in the Midwest, there's a bunch of different, you know, mitigation restoration companies. So like if you have a fire, a flood, some type of, you know, disaster, maybe it's asbestos, maybe you need lead based paint remediation, all those things. Right. So all the bad stuff when it comes to, you know, own a property and a terrible something has befallen you.
So what happened?
So I bought a commercial property a couple of years ago. About a month ago, it flooded, and it was a five-story building. The fourth floor and the third floor on two separate days had frozen pipes. ended up flooding the entire building, had to vacate the whole thing. There were 27 occupied units. One of them was a restaurant. The rest were offices. Disaster. Like, yeah. Terrible situation. Everybody had to basically get out of the building. Wasn't safe. We had, you know, thousands of gallons of water that were dumping in this place. Today's Golden Nugget is brought to you by JM Real Estate Capital.
Hi, it's Rob, JM Real Estate Capital. We're the money guys that you need to know for all your real estate investments. Talk to us. We can do what your local bank can't or won't do. We don't have millions. We have trillions with a T to lend. 844-WE-CLOSE or go online at jmrecapital.com. That's jmrecapital.com. JM Real Estate Capital, smart solutions for the real estate investor.
Golden nugget. I wasn't expecting you to go there.
I wasn't either. Yeah. This is my golden nugget for today. So when you get an insurance policy, there is a difference between actual cash value or ACV and replacement cost value. And generally, especially when you get a more expensive property like a commercial property, they're going to have a loss limit on your policy that'll say, we are, as an insurance company, we have a loss limit of X amount of dollars and we're not going to pay more than that. So whatever you need to do to get it, the building put back together, this is our limit on it. And if you have to come out of pocket for the rest of it, that's on you. Here's the most we're going to pay. Actual cash value, on the other hand, is where they basically take all the components of the building and they depreciate it based on the time that you've had it. So let's say you put in carpet 4 years ago, and let's say that carpet has a 5-year life, right? So they look at the lifespan of that carpet and they say, okay, you've eclipsed 4/5 of the life of this. So that means 20% of it is remaining. So instead of getting 100% replacement value, you're now getting 20% of it. And so that can make a huge swing on what you're going to do or what you can do with a property. Because on a property that gets up into the millions and millions of dollars, like this one is, you have to make a decision. You can't say, I'm just going to, you know, we're just going to replace everything no matter what. Because what if your loss limit gets eclipsed? What if the building has lead-based paint? What if it has asbestos? You now have to invite the city in and basically look at everything. So you're going to have to put in, you know, everything needs to be brought up to code typically if you're disturbing more than 50% of the building, depending on where you live. So that's what we're going through right now. And I'm trying to ask the adjuster, I'm like, okay, look, man, I'm not going to nail you down on anything with this question, but ballpark it for me. What am I looking at for actual cash value versus replacement value? Because if you're like, hey, Owen and partners, here's a check for XYZ. Let's say it's $2 million. Here's your check for $2 million. You guys can just walk away from this and sell the property for whatever you can sell it for. Or we'll give you $3.5 million if you do all of the work to the property. And what that means is you're going to have to go through and get the city involved on every single thing. And it's basically like new construction. And not only that, but you're going to have to remediate all of the environmental hazards that might exist in an old building, like lead-based paint, like asbestos, like, you know, you name it, all of those old things. So that's the challenge with renovating older buildings, is like sprinklering and like all of the legacy problems with construction back in those days that got grandfathered before you bought it. Now so, it comes to, you know, it's all coming home to roost.
Would have been better to just have it burned down.
Honestly, for the community, obviously not. It's a historic building and like we're super sad about this, but from a policyholder perspective, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, then it's pretty cut and dry on what you do. Now it's, we have no idea. Like, we can't make a plan on this because we have no clue on where we're going to land on the money available to renovate the building. Because it's like, we'd love to bring this thing back to life and make it nice again and, you know, welcome, you know, residents back in the building or tenants back in the building. But like, we just don't know. It could be 50% of what it's going to cost and we can't do it if that's the case.
Hey, so I was watching the news the other day and they were talking about Airbnbs in Vegas. And in this story on 60 Minutes, they were talking about how there were, I believe it was like 340,000 and a, I'm sorry, 240,000 and $180,000 fine that the city was putting against homeowners. And it was the highest fine that they've ever had because they had illegal Airbnbs. And from the day that they, that there was an issue that the complaint was filed, they charged a $500 a day fine against them, and this one house had was penalized 3 years prior, and they incurred all these fines on there for having an illegal Airbnb, and they're like, some people just go ahead and deal through it because they're making enough money to make them not worry about it, and some people think that it's not going to be an issue, and of course both of these people are fighting it in court, but like
how do you not think $500? Like, that doesn't make sense. I'm just saying, like, whoever's saying that $500 a day on an Airbnb unit doesn't matter, like, and they're like, oh, I can just roll with that. This is full of shit, like, is what I'm saying.
Well, they probably didn't, like, they probably didn't think
that's terrible. That is the worst possible scenario of anything that could happen.
Well, so now they're talking about, you know, putting a max to the amount of fines that they can, that
yeah,
they can give to somebody, because it's an endless number.
Yeah, it's okay. Come on. Oh, all right. Hotel lobby, you made your point. Like, chill out. Okay. Like, they, so evidently what you're saying is they banned Airbnb activity. Like, I don't know about each, Vegas. Like, you know more about
in this. In Vegas, any individual can have one Airbnb, period, in Las Vegas.
Okay.
And I think that there's, based on the story, it sounded like you can only have so many Airbnbs on the street also. So, these were in, you know, not compliant to their rules, and they were implementing the fines. And I'm like, I mean, it's just so over the top. It's just unbelievable.
So we talk about listeners in this episode with Justin Cambra. We talked about the fact that putting all of your eggs in one basket when it comes to real estate investing can be really incredibly risky. Especially when you're subject to legislation and stuff out of your control, there's no way for you to predict on how, like, the winds can change with legislation and lobbies and stuff like that. So it's a great news segment point that you brought up here, and it's just crazy to me that, like, cities can just all of a sudden on a whim decide that, okay, hey, that's cool that you decided to, like, leave your job and make a better thing for your family by making a short-term rental business. But guess what? We're just going to go ahead and torpedo that entire thing. So good luck getting a new job.
Welcome to Rio Radio, episode 117 with Justin Cambra.
Happy Friday.
Yeah.
10 o'clock a.m.
you are glowing
today. I hope there's whiskey in there.
Oh, there is not.
Hey, so real quick, remind me if I'm wrong. Did you leave Amazon? You got out of it, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, September 2nd, 2022. So Labor Day of 2022.
Were you just out bombed, like, boating around and, like, drinking a bunch of Coors Lights, and you're like, you know what? Screw those guys. I'm quitting today. And you called it in. Called it in, just left a voicemail.
Oh, no. It was actually, you know, I got a picture of it, and I got a video of me hitting the, you know, the send button, you know, my last day. So
did he really? Actually- oh, that's pretty clever. I wish I would have had the foresight for that. It was what of your 28 jobs that you had in the last 10 years, what did you leave before going into real estate full time? Was your last gig?
It definitely wasn't in the last 10 years, just so you know.
Oh, okay. 15?
In the last 10 years, I've only had technically one job.
Okay.
So, and that was at Thrasher when I did foundation repair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's some corporate guy with a little man syndrome, and he came in, he's just, like, threatening me left and right. And, you know, I'm like, you know what? I got an offer on the table, gave him a finger, and I put my notice in and was out. I was so done with that place. I appreciated the business and I appreciate everybody around, but they hired this manager and he didn't last much longer than probably a year.
Mm-hmm. Well, they say people leave managers, not companies.
If they would have never hired him, I probably would have stayed another couple of years, to be honest with you. So I was making great money. You know, I did lunch this week with Ethan Hamilton, a local investor, mm-hmm. and I was supposed to go have the, you know, the fancy.
Oh, yeah. He's at LinkedIn.
LinkedIn lunch, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And he got fired the day before.
That's hilarious because we talked about that. I've been there. I had that lunch,
yeah.
And it was pretty good.
And
you were bragging about going out there.
You're
like, oh yeah, I'm gonna get the LinkedIn lunch.
Yeah, he said that he got an email at 9:30 at night from the new VP guy of engineering or whatever it was, and he didn't respond till like in the morning. And at 8 in the morning, he called him in, like, you didn't respond to this email. He's like, oh, yeah. So he's like, jumped in, took care of it real quick, got the appointment set up for the next day. And then he got fired on the spot for not responding to the 9:30 email from the VP.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay.
I mean, like, there's corporate life for you.
No kidding.
Right? So I figured Justin had a story like that for us.
Yeah, man. Oh. So, like, we were, Ted and I, he actually had to jog my memory about this, but I think we meaning us three, We met at which BPCon was that?
It was New Orleans, right?
New Orleans, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, on Bourbon Street, of all places, which explains why I don't really remember it very well. But when I saw your, because I was like, Justin Camera, who is that? That name sounds so familiar. He's like, oh, yeah, you know him. And I'm like, yeah. And then in my head, I'm like, hell, I don't know him at all. And then I saw your face, and I was like, yeah, what? And then, you know, now here we are. But you worked for Amazon for a long time. Like you, like 10 years, 9 years, 10 years, something like that?
Yeah, I was 9 total years. I was 1 year away from the next badge level. Yeah, I want to say the next badge was like red. So I called it the red badge of courage. If you can make it to the 10 years. So I was on the 5 year badge still, which is like an orangish color.
What do you have, like stock options and some other benefits if you would have stayed?
Oh, yeah. No. If you're not familiar with the tech world, a lot of them have options or restricted stock units, which are always future paying, you know, compensation. So no matter when you leave, you're going to have money on the table. I don't remember what was on the table when I left, but it was like, you just got to get comfortable with knowing that that money is not there.
So restricted stock options, that's RSU. And I actually was going to ask you about that because I know I just doing some research on your background and so forth. I saw you had mentioned on a few different places like RSU. And I was like, I don't really know what that means. And then so restricted stock options are basically
options is O, not U. So it would be RSO.
U is for unit.
Thank you. Fact checker. RSU. So restricted stock units. Is that what it is? And that's a tech forward way of limiting people's ability to be mobile in employment, right? It's got teeth. So you leave, you're leaving money on the table. That's kind of the gist of it.
100%. So usually these companies, you come in, you get a base salary, and then you get a restricted stock unit amount. So let's just say it's 100 units. Typical at Amazon was those 100 units vest over 4 years. Year one, you get 5%. Year two, you would get 15%. Year three and four, every 6 months, you'd get 20%. So it's very super backloaded. So, you know, people churned over every 2 years, like they're leaving, you know, 80% of all their RSUs on the table. So if you're in and you make it past the year, you gotta continue to go because there's all that future money out there. Once you get into your fifth year, then it's just on a, you know, you have some that you get new, some that are vesting. So there's constant cycle after you get there through that initial 4 year period.
You know what's interesting about that? You have to imagine that, like, you know, Bezos kind of goes in and out from being the richest person in the world. But like, obviously, they have put a lot of time and resources into studying the trends of why and how people leave companies and the timing of it. So they probably determine, like, hey, years one and two, you got a lot of churn. So this is a way you can keep them in the driver's seat for as long as you can. And then after the fourth year, they're probably like, hey, we sucked 4 years of your life out and got to use your talents because of that. But then they reissue more. And I'm sure it probably is a way of filtering too, you know, like you're shaking out kind of the people that aren't built to last with the company. I don't know. It's always interesting. I worked in corporate recruiting and HR. So I got exposed to a lot of like different benefit plans and strategies and compensation plans. And they do a lot of research on that stuff. But yeah, having the handcuffs around you for RSU. Yeah, that's interesting.
That's a unit, so, unit, not an option.
So you obviously vested yours. You got to participate in enjoying the financial windfall, and they kept reissuing. But like, when did you get to the point where you're like, you know what, I'm out. I don't care about all the like stuff you keep dangling on a year over year basis. I want to make my own way, because you were doing this as a side hustle and then ended up pulling the trigger. You want us to maybe I'll just be quiet and let you tell the story. Since it's, you know, you're the guest on the podcast, not me.
Oh, but you like to tell everybody's story.
Hey, listen, man, I did dry January, okay? So this is already affecting me, Ted.
One drink, man.
I'm back to lightweight status. Yeah, did you hit a like tipping point with your real estate investing where you said, you know what, I'm finally comfortable in basically pulling the plug on my corporate career, and I'm just going to go like all in on real estate investing? When was that for you?
Yeah, so for me, that was in 2022, and my goal for 2022 was to instead of retiring, I call it graduating to the next level and just run my own investment business. And so For me, really, the tipping point wasn't necessarily the rentals. I'm trying to jog my memory at the time. I was in the 40 to 45 properties, 110, 120-ish doors at the time that was kicking off the monthly cash flow. But what really got me was that the first 6 months of 2022, I did two deals within my what I call active real estate business. I did one wholesale deal and I did one fix and flip. Those two deals generated almost $100,000. At Amazon in 6 months, I made almost $100,000. So I'm spending like at least 80% of my time at Amazon. I made 100. I spent 20% of my time over here and I made 100. I was like, what if I went 100% on my active real estate? That was really when the light switched and I was like, man, I could make multiples more just by doing 100% real estate.
Was that like the seed money to get it going? I mean, it's nice to have a job that's paying you $200,000 a year to be able to get the loans that you need, because especially when you're getting started. So, I mean, there had to been that you had to waive that decision a little bit, right?
Yeah. So I started back investing in. So really when I started at Amazon, I was like, man, this is a lot of money, but I actually hated it. So in 2013, so all my original money and RSUs, I paid all my debt off, Dave Ramsey model. Mm-hmm. And so then I started accumulating cash and then I finally got into real estate in 2016. So from 2016 all the way to 2022 that I was buying using the RSUs, when they'd come in these big chunks, I would be buying real estate. And then I would be living below my means to then save up more money to buy more real estate.
You are speaking Ramsey talk there, aren't you?
Yeah. So the first 6 years, I was just heads down. I almost forget buying properties because I was so focused on just buying the next one. And I built out that portfolio and it was kicking off roughly about 10,000 at the time. So I had the passive income coming in, obviously not the 200,000 Amazon income coming in. But for me, it was like, man, now I'm getting these big chunks of money. If I just keep doing these big chunks of money in my active real estate business, man, I can make so much more.
How were you finding those deals? I mean, that's a lot of deals to find. Or was this in the pre-2020 timeframe and it was just a little different, a little easier?
Yeah. So for context, I'm in Seattle and, you know, my first property was in Seattle, a house hack. I actually still live there.
It's really expensive to buy there too.
Say that again?
It's really expensive to buy there.
Oh, 100%. Crazy town. Yeah. And even more so now than back then. But most of my portfolio is in the Midwest. So Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Detroit, and then most recently last year, Des Moines, Iowa. So kind of in your backyard.
Have you been down to Des Moines?
Yeah.
You didn't call us? Come on.
Yeah. Next time I'm in town. Yeah. Because I think they're really close to Nebraska there. And I went into Nebraska for a hot minute.
It's about an hour and a half drive from here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So next time in Des Moines, come to our meetup. Maybe you can plan out around a meetup so we can hang out.
Yeah. Do you have it on a certain day each month?
We have it on first Tuesdays, unless it's a holiday week.
First Tuesday. Okay.
Yeah. And actually, Des Moines has a pretty cool meetup. There's a lot of really cool people there too. They have theirs monthly and it's usually at like a bar or a brewery or whatever. I've been there a couple of times. There's some good people there. So yeah, next time you come in, man. How did so? Why did you pick those cities? Like, I get why you chose Seattle. It's your backyard. You know it. It's super expensive. Obviously, a high cost of living area. I'm assuming that's probably why you looked outside of the market. Like, what did you go through process wise or people wise to make you feel comfortable in choosing Des Moines, Iowa, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and what was the other one? Detroit.
Yep.
Yeah. Why those places?
Yeah. So when I joined Amazon, I got my MBA and I did a whole career switch from operations into finance. So when I'm at Amazon, I'm learning finance, you know, on the fly there. So for me, analyzing properties became super simple. And I found out very quickly that nothing cash flows in Seattle. So I was like, well, I have all these Amazon RSUs coming in, these big tranches of RSUs. I've got to go spend it on something to get me out of this rent race. And so my initial move out of Seattle was actually 3 hours away in a city called Yakima. It's in the middle of the state of Washington. My brother lives there. I was looking on LoopNet and I found I think it was 11 unit apartment complex that I bought back in 2017. That was kind of my first foray out because I was like, nothing cash flows in Seattle. Let me check other stuff nearby. That one ended up cash flowing. So at the time, it was, I think I bought it for $285 for 11 units. Just like one big like Frankenstein like house.
Yeah, I was going to say this had to be either a conversion or a crack house or something, right? I mean, that's even for, you know, 7 years ago, that's still pretty dang cheap, especially in Washington.
Yeah,
crack house.
Exactly. It was a little bit of both, to be honest. So then I got that one. Then I was like, man, you know, because at Amazon, I was getting every 6 months, I'd have a tranche of RSUs. And then at that same time, about end of 2016, 2017, I heard about BiggerPockets. And I was like, oh, man, BiggerPockets, this is amazing. All this free information. And then one guy, I don't even know who it was, said, you know, if you're just starting right now, you should go back to episode one and catch all the way up. And then I went on 2X. It took me a couple months, but I caught up through like 200 episodes.
They were so bad on the first like 10 ups. I mean, they were terrible. We were joking about the, you know, like sound quality and like all the stuff that goes into podcast production. But like,
Justin, you ever heard our first 10 episodes before?
They were also.
No, I was listening to your recent stuff, you know, like, you know, you had Pace Morby and you had your, I think it was your 100 episode. You know,
yep.
You guys are much more polished now, I'm sure.
The first 10 episodes. I mean, we had wireless microphones and the crackle was in there and
so bad. Yeah. People doing burnouts right outside the window.
Like, yeah, no, there was no lighting or sound treatments or anything. Yeah.
Nice.
So okay, like, walk us through, you're in Seattle, you bought an 11plex in Yakima, and it sounded like that was probably a pretty heavy lift, is that fair to say? And then you saw a lot of cash flow out of that, imagine, for the low purchase price. What happened after that, and where did that fall in your, like, in the grand scheme of things, like your real estate holdings? Was that purchase number 20 or was that really early on?
That was number 2. Wow. Yeah, so
11,
my first one was a house hack, a duplex. I still live there. One bedroom I live in, 3 bedroom down below. That's a medium term rental. I rent my parking lot as well, so I get paid $1,300 a month to live there. The second one, this Yakima one, you're saying you must it must be a heavy lift. I was so green, and so I had so much, you know, fire that I wanted to get out of the corporate world. I didn't know what I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just like, oh, I found it on LoopNet, and then I found a local agent, and I was like, hey, I want to put an offer on this. And they're like, great, let's put an offer in. And then we're like, what are you going to do for financing? And, you know, so then I went to the guy that I bought my house with, and he's like, well, I can't do that loan because it's commercial. I'm like, what's commercial? And he's like, if it's 5 units or more, that's commercial. And then I'm like, oh, okay, well, then how do I get a commercial loan? Then that guy sent me to another guy who was commercial. And so it's just how I invested, is like, I get to a block and I don't know what to do. And then I ask people, they help me, and then I go to the next step. So then I was like, how do I get a property manager? And, you know, as I was catching up through all those BiggerPockets episodes, there's a guy named Enrique Jevons, which is like the king of Yakima. And so I knew he was going to go to this local meetup. And I met him there, and I was like, hey, I'm buying this property. Can you help me? And he's like, sure. And so he ended up helping me, you know, on the acquisition and getting it all transitioned, and he managed it for me. So it wasn't really a heavy lift because I had talked to other people to help me get in and get it all set up.
He's like the Owen of Omaha.
No, that's really cool. So you kind of did so you're what, 45 now? Is that right?
In June. Yeah, I'll be 45.
Okay.
Dang, you're old, man. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay. He's 43. Let's set expectations here. And an old 43, as you can tell.
Hey, I gave you a compliment on your age just the other day. I said I met somebody that was in Owen's class the other day.
Like, a year ahead of me.
And I mean, gosh, this guy looked like he was hitting close to 70. And I go, oh, and man, I go, you look really young compared to that guy. So I get, you didn't even respond to that.
You know, he listens to these, right? So
you didn't even respond to that.
No, I didn't. I just figure that this is the way you deal with it. Listen, if he asks you a question you don't want to answer, just don't answer it. Okay. It's just me and you talking. All right. This is how this is going
to
go.
Welcome to our podcast.
Yeah. Justin. So Yakima, Washington, my first thought is, okay, this is 3 hours away from you. It's the equivalent of buying something halfway across the country because what's the difference, right? You're either hopping on a flight or you're hopping in your car and driving 3 hours. So what were your next steps? It sounded to me like you said, okay, I just thought I could buy this with my normal mortgage, you know, broker or lender or whatever. You figured out, oh yeah, I need a commercial loan. What are those? You figured that out. What did you do to operate this and do repairs and move outs and like handle contractors and showings and all that? Like what are the steps if you're going to, you know, do something similar to what you're talking about? High cost of living area. You found something within your state, but it's far enough away to be a huge pain in the ass to have to do a lot of stuff yourself. Like go time. You got to put people in seats. And what are the seats? What do you have to do to find those people?
Yeah. So for me, like, I lucked out. I remembered Enrique Jevons owned like 100 something doors out in Yakima. So I highly leaned on him, leveraged him, where it was, you know, almost completely hands off. I'm only getting involved on anything $500 limit or above. And, you know, that property was more of your, what I call a cash cow. I'm not trying to increase it, the value of it. It was just kind of a really old building. A lot of deferred maintenance. I was just keeping the tenants happy, not really raising the rents that very much. And Enrique and his team did the lion's share of the work for me. So I really didn't have to do a whole lot. It was only when larger problems would come up is when I get involved.
Just one question I have for you is, how has your investing strategy changed? Like before, you were just kind of looking for a deal, right? And you're like, hey, something that's here works great, but like compared to from then to now, like what's your buying criteria now?
Yeah. So my buy criteria, I'm in a unique situation when there's a window. So I was extremely bankable at Amazon. Mm-hmm. And then from Amazon to today, I'm having to rebuild my bankability. And by that,
even with the size of a portfolio of your size, you have issues, huh?
Yeah. Between that and then the other thing, like for me, like I'm a real estate agent now too. So I help my friends buy properties locally or out of state. So like as I'm building like 2 years of this agent income and then my wholesale and fix and flip income to kind of show higher liquidity and income levels, what I've been focusing really the last since I left and even a little bit before I left, predominantly creative finance deals. The reason for that is there are zero banks involved. I can do any deal in the world without a bank. Once the bank's involved, they have the capability of shutting it down, you know, approving me or not approving me. And so the last year and a half, pretty much everything I bought, that one in Des Moines, Iowa, I secured it on a lease with the option to purchase. I sold properties in Milwaukee and I cashed out there, did a 1031, exercised my option to purchase into a subject to deal. So none of that required any banks and it allowed me to take four greens and then go into one red. And that's what I've been focused on. Now, my future, now that I'm more bankable, I'm continuing to do the Monopoly model, four greens for one red, but you know, start getting in more bank financing.
How many 1031s have you been involved in since you started?
I've done three as of last year. I just finished one in September.
Yeah, 1031.
How many have you done?
I think five.
Okay. I'm yet to do one. Like I've done them for clients, but I've never done one myself.
Yeah. So, Justin, would you mind just briefly describe why you did a 1030, what it is and why you did one? What does that help you with as a real estate investor for those that don't know?
So real estate investing is about managing your equity, your cash. And then the bigger you get, you know, when you talk about like you had Pace Morgan on the other day, it is all about keeping the money, meaning you don't want to be giving Uncle Sam all you have to pay tax on all this. So, you know, if you just go sell a property, depending on short-term or long-term capital gains, you get a chunk that you're paying to the government. Now, if you do a 1031, which is the tax code number for this like-kind exchange, the money that you get out of selling, as long as you put it all into new property and you follow their criteria for timing and debt levels and all that, you can roll forward your money, defer the taxes, and basically all the money you get to keep using. And the goal of that is that you know, you just kind of defer it until you die, and then you can hand down your assets through your trust or your will, however you see fit, to minimize the tax of any tax events of your portfolio.
Who are you handing this down to?
You know, I don't have any kids, but I do have three brothers with kids.
Yeah.
And so that would be the initial handing down.
Yeah. You know how to have kids, though. So, you know, maybe it'll happen.
You know, I'm on the older side. You know, we're just mentioning that, right? But my girlfriend is 50. So we're past that phase of our life. So I'm just the funkle. And, you know, I come in, we have fun, and then, you know, give them back to the parents, hey, my brothers.
You can always adopt.
That's true.
There's always options out there, buddy.
So anyway, back to away from, you know, whatever he's pushing on you, having kids. So you left your job in 2022. Like, okay, let's real world this. You were used to getting a waterfall of cash events when you could exercise your option to purchase and then sell Amazon options, correct? So the stock market, basically, yep. They're like, I did my time. Here's your reward for all the time you put in. You took that cash, plowed it into real estate. Sounds like you leveled up by doing a 1031 exchange to your advantage, got into some larger assets. But if you don't mind, like, this may be a little bit of a step back in your process or your journey here, but talk about the parking lot situation. I read this article that you had out there, and you talked about there was a parking lot or a parking spot, and you ended up basically arbitraging that or like somehow leveraging that into cash flow for you. What was that like? What did it end up being? How can people like apply this?
And in the end, tell us how you got into Newsweek.
What was that last part, Ted?
Then after that, tell us how you got into Newsweek with that article.
Oh, okay. Got it. So it's actually not that old. So that actually started in January of 2023. So I was going to Detroit, and I was there for a conference, and I was meeting up with an ex-Amazon guy. When I travel into the areas, I like to meet up with local people, investors and stuff, you know, or Instagram friends to meet them in person. And so when I met with this guy, he was telling me about he's renting his garage out. I think it's like $150-$200. And I was like, wait, tell me about this, because at my house in Seattle, I've got 20 to 30 stalls of space on my lot. And he told me about this app called Neighbor. And I was like, oh, my God, this is like the greatest thing. Like, I can use this at my house. So from when I left him at Starbucks, in the Uber to the airport, downloaded the app, loaded pictures in, created my profile, posted a parking stall. Within less than a month, I got my first parking customer through the Neighbor app. And, you know, the first one I think I got was like $213 a month. And, you know, because the reason why I have all this space is when I bought this house that I live in, it used to be part of a larger lot. The lot to the north of me, the owner has three fourplexes. And he used to live in the house that I bought. Well, he subdivided it, and he had the three fourplexes on one side and this duplex with all the parking for those three fourplexes. So when I bought my duplex, there's literally all this parking that used to be for the 12 units next door. So I've just had this space for 6 years, never used it. And then in 2013 or 2023, I actually started being able to monetize it. And it was kind of, what I did is because I never used it, literally it was like a jungle out there. You know, shrubs were growing everywhere around there. So the first client came in, I made $213, and I got another one. Then I called my gardeners out and said, hey, clear out more space. And so I did these like three big tranches, like $1,000 each time. And then they just cleared out. now my entire parking lot is 100% cleaned up. And, you know, I don't know exactly how many stalls, but 20 to 30 stalls of parking spots. And, you know, at my peak, I had, I think, about 14 stalls. Now I have 8-9 of them rented, average about $150 a piece.
Is that your most lucrative piece of real estate?
Yes, because my land is actually worth more than the house. Today, I can build 8 houses on my land. But I'm going to wait till the next cycle. I'm just land banking it right now. And then I'll build townhomes in the future on it.
Wow, that is so cool, man. So you basically kind of repurposed unutilized space and made a pretty nice income out of it. And this is like, I was thinking about this the other day. I was I don't know if you ever get on Reddit, but I kind of dive into the rabbit hole on Reddit sometimes on different topics. And they have stuff where there's actually some people that put a lot of thought into their posts. It's not just like posting like Facebook can be sometimes or other social media. Did you see I got a thumbs up there? Look at that. They like my shit posting content or comment. But I don't know why I'm getting thumbs up. This is so funny. Sorry, this is the software or whatever that we're using for the podcast that randomly gives you a thumbs up. We got fireworks earlier. That was exciting.
Yeah, we don't know how we got fireworks, but we got fireworks.
A lot of hand gestures or something. We don't know. Anyway, so I was reading this thread on Reddit, and like, you know how sometimes there's people that just don't know and they're just commenting, and people are like putting out stuff that's totally not true. And you have the tendency, or at least I do, like if you know a lot about whatever they're talking about, you want to chime in and be like, no, that's completely wrong. Don't take advice off of even me. Don't take advice from me either, but like do fact check here. This is totally wrong. And it was like, I'm just looking on there, and it was a thread about basically people that are really wealthy, and then they were painting those people into a corner of they're just rich and they don't care about this and this and this, and like they're just greedy landlords and whatever. And all of us have seen these posts a million times. My thought went to, you know, innately, I think people tend to want to criticize people that are more successful in some facet of their life than they are. I think it's easy. They're easier targets, and it makes people feel better about their own station in life if they, somehow pick a scab on the people that maybe are higher up on the, social economic level or just successful in business or whatever it is. But I was thinking like, you know, because everybody roots for the underdog, right? So, you know, you're like, hey, I want to start my own business. Everybody's cheering for you. You're like, hey, good for you. Go get them, man. Like, you're going to do this and this and that. And then, you know, entrepreneurs, I mean, it's one of the hardest possible business paths you can choose because you have to wear so many hats during it. It's very confusing, and you don't have a lot of allies in the beginning, and you're relying on basically your grit and your determination and your motivation and all those things to build a business. And if you actually make it through the gauntlet of creating and running a small business as an operator, and you make it 5 years, which, you know, whatever the, what's the saying, like 10% of the 10% end up making it 5 years or more in business. And then let's say you actually start growing and you have some success and you become like a smaller, medium sized business where you have staff and so forth. At what point do you start being the people that or the person that people quit rooting for? At what point is it okay for people to say, you're just a greedy rich person? It's like, dude, you were rooting for me like a year ago. What happened between now and then that says I'm a bad guy, and all of a sudden we're on opposite sides of the fence? We're not. Like, we're in the same. Right. I just happened to grit through all of this, and now I'm operating a successful business, and now I'm getting all the shade from people. I don't know. I just kind of I kind of wanted to reply to that. I was just like, this is just a complete train wreck.
Welcome to social media.
Exactly. But I started thinking about that. Like, I think people actually go around thinking those things where at some point in your life as a business owner, there is a point of no return where you are now rich and greedy, whereas last week you were gritty and successful despite adversity and all of the challenges that are involved in running and operating a business. I just think it's sad. It's sad that people want to, like, you know, it's the whole like crabs in a bucket effect. you know, the one that makes it to the top. Every other crab will reach up and pull them down. That's a thing, Ted.
I didn't know that.
So I don't know. I'm going off of on a tangent here, but it just makes it really. It's unfortunate that is the society we live in, where you can be successful and everybody liked you up until the point where they thought you were better than them. And then it's like questioning or poking holes in your accomplishments and all this. I don't know. Maybe I'm putting my own stuff out here.
I just want to lift you up, buddy. I mean, if you need a hug, I'll give you a hug.
Get off me.
I
got
you. Boy, that dry January and you got one drink in you and then you're just filling the tea.
This is therapy. Hey, this is my therapy, man.
No, kid. This is the thing I look forward to every week and all week. When we do the best part of our days at dinner at night, this is the best part of the day.
just to follow up on what you're saying, that point, you know, in your talking there on your monologue, basically I was just in Italy and I was thinking of that I don't know if it's there's this famous painting that's up on the in this church. I'm totally drawing a blank, but it's that guy with he's pointing his finger out. But as soon as people think that they can't connect and touch you, now you're at an elevated state, and then that's when they start taking shots at you. So it is very you know, I hope to get to that level someday because that means I'm successful.
Oh, but, wait, you've been to Italy. Sorry, Mr. Success.
Right.
Oh, no, now you're bashing on Justin for going to Italy.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I did there. Tell us about in the, you know, research fashion that we do here at ReRadio, I noticed that you participate somehow in Turo. Is that still a thing for you?
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about this because I have a business partner and they have a couple of Turos, and actually they just did like a webinar, a couple webinars today about it. What is Turo? Take a stab at maybe describing it. Why did you get involved and what's that look like for you?
So Turo, conceptually, it's the Airbnb for cars. And so what you're doing is you're renting out your car to people via an app. And, you know, I started this back in right after I left Amazon. So a friend of mine, his name is Scotty T, he was saying, hey, like, you're going to leave Amazon. And he's like, you better do something. Otherwise, you're just going to become a piece of and I was like, oh, okay. So he's like, hey, like, I'm doing the Turo thing. I'm making money. I'm like, sure, I'll try this out. You know, I like trying new revenue streams. And so then we go to, you know, this is in middle of, you know, COVID. So it's kind of hard to get cars actually during that time. So I was like, yeah, I'll just copy what you're doing. I left Amazon September 2nd. So in the month of September, I had a job and I went and applied to get a car. And I ordered the next Subaru Crosstrek that was coming in. And then I was talking to my girlfriend about it. I was like, man, if I'm doing this, and they didn't even, you know, everything, all the credit went through. And then I was like, why don't I just do two of them? So I got, you know, I'd already quit my job, but, you know, middle of September, I ended up getting two cars, zero down. And I launched this Turo project. And, you know, I was doing all the work at the beginning, you know, because I didn't have a job. So, but I quickly realized, I was like, man, this kind of sucks because you're at the beck and call of when they're coming in, and then you got to clean it, and then you've got to coordinate the keys and the handoff and everything. And, you know, I was like, it's kind of cool. Saw the revenue go up the first 3 months. It was just like 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, you know, going up. You know, that's combined total revenue for the cars. And, you know, my monthly cost is about 1,500. And I was like, wow, man, this thing could really take off. And then January 2023 happened. And basically, I woke up and all the national rental car companies are like, screw these Turo people. And, you know, I live 3 miles from the SeaTac airport. Like, literally, they dropped the prices from like $80 to like back to the old days, $15 a rental. So in January, for me to compete, for people, because people have to take an Uber to my house, rent the car, and go. The Uber to my house is roughly equivalent to the tax that National Hertz Enterprise has to charge their customers for being on the airport. So I had to lower my price structure, and I was renting the same amount, but the dollar per day went down. And so I was like, oh, man, this kind of sucks, but I already own these cars. So that point was like, man, I don't know if I want to keep doing it. So I wasn't going to buy any more cars. Now, how do I continue to go, but then get my time out of it? You know, when I was doing the math, I was making $20 an hour to do this tour. I was like, this is like a no brainer. I shouldn't be doing it. Also, other friends of mine telling me like, hey, you're an idiot. Like, why are you doing $20 an hour?
I did not know that about the, so basically they banded together, kind of almost created a, like a consortium of industry members and said, we don't like the threat that this little startup is potentially introducing here into our, economic ecosystem. So let's hurt them bad. And that was they basically did an assault on Turo and said, we're going to cut we're going to absorb the losses in hopes that we're going to wash out a whole bunch of competition. Is that kind of the gist?
They didn't band together. Let's get this straight. This is my interpretation of what happened, where they're like, my assumption is they had all these cars just sitting on extra cars idle, and they're like, hey, they're running their same revenue models as well. Dollar per day times bookings equals revenue, right? And it just so happened in January they all restructured independently on how they're gonna charge. And then, because like for me, like before I actually got the Turo, back to my Amazon finance days, I needed a proof of concept. So I went in and went through and checked all the, since I'm 3 miles from the airport, all these rental car companies, what is the average for an SUV? And then I was like, oh man, if I only had 20 days at $100, I could make $2,000 per car for $4,000 a month, was my initial research. But when they started dropping those down to like 15 and 20 bucks, okay, now those economics, are not in my favor. Luckily over time, those have kind of increased, and now it's more of a kind of trendy seasonality. And I'm able to, I do a rev share now with a lady that manages it for me. So at the end of the month, I analyze it. I pay her out her rev share, and I have like basically zero involvement except for the monthly payout of rev share.
How'd you find her?
From the same guy who got me into it. So Scotty T.
Scotty T.
Yeah,
he's so, got it.
Thank goodness, because it's a lot of work. For me, where it really hit me, I was in Chichen Itza, and somebody was checking a car out, and I had to like go out into the main area so my cell phone could get signal to remote unlock the car for the guests. And I'm like, oh, thank God this actually worked. And then I was like, I can't be, my goal is to, have this lifestyle where I can travel where I want. Having the Turo was tying me down to where like I had to be on, because I'm in different time zones and not always great cell reception. So I needed to get that pushed off to somebody else so I could, have more free time, vacation time, wherever I want, when I want.
I really want to hear you pronounce Chichen Itza. Is that
Chichen Itza? Chichen Itza.
Yeah, that's what I was expecting.
There you go. I did that just for you.
All right, let's shift gears back into the more profitable margin wise places that you could put your money. What's next for you?
Des Moines, Iowa,
clearly. But you left your job not quite 2 years ago. What does your world look like now from and here's where I'm going with this. I want to understand expectations versus reality when you live or when you're working in a high income job and you started to build your portfolio prior to quitting. You did it the right way. You have a proof of concept. You got some cash flow built up. But I would imagine this is just me guessing, but it's not like your cash flow is going to allow you to walk away from a $200,000 a year job and you're not making that much in cash flow, right? So there's a gap. Yes, you have equity, but how are you paying the bills, and what does your life look like? Sounds like you're traveling. That's great. How do you do the day to day when you're a guy or a gal that wants to leave their profession, but they're like, God, they're paying me so much money. This is going to be really hard to replace. Maybe talk about that for a sec.
Yeah. So the underlying secret here, I told you guys, I'm still in the same original house I bought. I get paid like $1,300 a month to live there. Your number one expense is generally your housing, right? So like, since I get paid to live there, I've taken out like the highest cost bucket. So leave that as the foundation. Most people don't do that. As they make more money, they increase their living style, they buy new cars, they buy new houses, and they have a lot of, you know, these monthly costs just for living. So my cost of living is low. So now what does my like daily life look like? So if I, you know, what I ended up doing is like getting more of those active income. So I was finding these deals off market, and I have like a single family fixer with a detached accessory dwelling unit that I'm going to build in the backyard. And then I bought one property that has two houses on it. I'm short platting that to three lots, selling the two houses, build a third house and sell that. And so if I hadn't done these deals, which I'm learning now, like I could just marinate. But because I bought these and I have hard money costs and I have, you know, there's a lot of fronting of money when you start doing these development projects, I've had to engage a lot more on my agent business. So my agent business, I'm averaging now about a transaction a week. And for the area that I'm in, the median is roughly, it just dropped below 800,000. So that helps fund these development projects to help me to increase my wealth, and then big chunks of money where I can continue to travel.
Now, a deal a week is not small potatoes. Like, how are you getting?
No, deal a month.
A deal a month. Okay. That's not as impressive.
Yeah. No, my goal is a deal a week though. Yeah. I mean, at that point,
cause I'm like, holy moly, a deal a week. You are like,
I was sitting here thinking that too. I'm like, holy.
Yeah.
I get probably like maybe two a month, I think on average, but deal a week is some baller activity, right?
Especially in Seattle.
Yeah.
Hey, okay. Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Des Moines, Iowa, Detroit. Why? Why those places? Like, do you have a filter where you're applying market data, you know, all that stuff? Or is it more like you have boots on the ground there and you have people that know, like, and trust the market? Maybe talk about that if you're investing out of your area.
Yeah. A lot of people ask me that question, and I never really did a whole lot of work. I just kind of, you know, bias for action, jump in and go with it. So I heard about Milwaukee, Wisconsin on Bigger Pockets, you know, when I was catching up through all those episodes. Some guy that I don't know his name today's younger guy at the time, he was saying, yeah, I'm buying these cheap properties in Milwaukee for like $60,000. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. That's after I bought my second property, that one in Yakima. And then I was like, well, I have all this money, I need to keep buying. And I have friends that I would go on this golf trip with to Madison. And so I was like, well, why don't I just fly into Milwaukee, check Milwaukee out, and then go to the golf trip? And then I went, met some agents in the area, and then I was like, oh my God, this is Seattle with one less zero at the end. So instead of $600,000 for a duplex, it was $60,000.
Okay.
Now these properties they're, you know, 100 years old, a lot of deferred maintenance, but for me, I was like, throw the Excel spreadsheet out the window. $60K and they rent for $700 per door. Like, there's, you don't even need to do math. Like, and then that's where I was just like, started buying those. Like, I was basically on a tear for like every other month I was buying a property.
Does this sound familiar? Starting with $10K and buying 52 units in 3 years with Chris Huron, episode 197 in 2016 on BP. That had been the one he listened to.
Chris Huron?
H-E-E-R-E-N.
Might have been him.
Yeah, I think that's the only Wisconsin one that comes up on the BP.
Our crack research team over here.
Yeah.
Ted's wearing a lot of hats today as podcast production. Like, we've had some setup and lighting and like all kinds of stuff.
This is what happens when Owen talks more than I do. I get to do the research.
That's true. Yeah. You can add other things to your plate.
See, I am valuable.
Anyway,
in regards to the Toro deal, I mean, is there special insurance you have to get? Because a lot of times when you get loans, they don't want you to Uber. Like, there's specific rules right in there that says you can't Uber. And I'm assuming that Toro is right there with it. Did you have to get special permission on your loan? And did you have to let your insurance know what you're doing? Or did you just kind of like, I'm just going to wing it and hope I don't get an accident. Nobody can go from here.
Yeah, I just I didn't ask questions. I just did it.
Okay.
And that's specifically the insurance, yes, I have what's called it's like a transportation rider, something like that. So my insurance obviously is higher because I have this rider that goes into it.
Okay. I was just wondering. I know that we're backtracking here, but it is something that was on my mind. But
that's how I do things. Like, you know, I understand my whole thing is if you understand the rules of the game, you know how to compete. And so I ask people what the rules are, and then I determine how I want to interpret them and how I want to operate.
Maybe you want to go into business and buy a Turo together?
I don't know why you're not operating a Turo like full-fledged business. Ted is a car junkie. He literally buys cars. He has bought more cars probably in the last 2 years than I have in my entire life. And I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
So I don't know why you're not doing this. Out of anybody that I know, this is the business for you. Why?
And I can have fun, fancy cars?
Yeah. And it's like it's not like they cost as much as a house. So,
well, actually, I think my new truck payment is almost as much as my house payment.
I believe it. Ted got a Ford Lightning, which I just heard they're not going to be making anymore. Did you know this?
I heard they cut production down by half because of the tax credit went away.
Because their profit is actually 50% less than what it is on normal, your regular gas, cars that run on gas.
I believe it. And they took the $7,500 tax credit away that started this year.
Yeah.
For electric vehicles. But that vehicle is, that thing is, that's the best vehicle I've ever owned yet.
Yeah,
it is amazing. Well, I hope you
One that has 500 horsepower, right? It's got some ridiculous horsepower.
Yeah, it's like 0 to 60 in 3.8 seconds, and it's the fastest thing. I mean, it's faster than any of the Mustangs I've ever owned.
Yeah, I'm sure that does well on the icy roads there.
It did really well because it's all-time all-wheel drive.
Yeah.
And we had this big snowstorm a few weeks ago. I was out there having fun in it.
All right, Justin, what we always like to ask people on our podcast here is what has not gone well for you? Because, like we were talking about people like rooting for the underdog until they get more successful. So what's a bad deal that has happened to you or like something like crazy or weird that has happened at a property that you bought?
Oh, man, I've done so many. I have a lot of them. There's one that I have right now. I probably shouldn't bring up. It may go to litigation, so I won't bring that one up. But the one in the past that I've had, let's see, just in terms of problems. Oh, there's one specifically that so when I was trying to leave Amazon, I had some private money on this Burr project. It was a sixplex in Yakima. And trying to work with this loan officer was like super slow and they kept dragging out. The appraisal came in low and I'm like, this is just killing me because I wanted to leave in June. It took me 3 months to get through all the financing and do this cash out refi, pay my private money lenders off and get into a 5-year commercial loan. That's an example where I was just super painful. Like every day I'm like, I need to get this loan while I'm at Amazon to secure it and then be able to get out of it. And it was just mind numbing. I'm like, hey, the info is here. Like, what's going on? Like, speed this up. That was one of them.
Yeah. It's so funny, how quickly things can change with regards to financing and the environment of lending and real estate in general. And it's you got to pay attention to that stuff because you could have built your whole business on a couple years worth of experience that you had. And then all of a sudden they come out with new legislation or new tax laws or new whatever. And then
banning Airbnb or something.
Yeah. Or yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what's so challenging about this is that you think you have it figured out and then you have curveballs that come at you all the time with stuff you have to adjust to and figure out is it even still viable for this to be part of my business or am I going to have to shut that down and go on to the next thing?
Justin, we brought this up in our intro before this got started and we were talking about the Las Vegas. Did you hear about this story where The city fined the Airbnb owners. One was $240,000 and the other one was $180,000. $500 every day from the point that they got were not legally allowed to have Airbnbs, and because there's only so many Airbnbs allowed per street. I mean, talking about ruining your business model or just destroying you.
Right. Well, that's like, you bring up a great topic because, like, and this is what, you know, thinking about finance and my MBA is like, you've got to evaluate your risk and revenue, you know? So like, as I, you know, look at my investing, I was getting the equity in the Washington and then, Seattle area. And then in Milwaukee, Detroit, now Des Moines is, that was my cash flow. So I'm balancing my portfolio that way. But I do have one medium-term rental. I do have 4 short-term rental, and then 110-ish are long-term. When I started getting into the short-term rental, I'm like, holy crap, this is amazing, you know? I'm making all this money, and it was just ripping. That was 2022. 2023, I'm down, like, I need to analyze it, but ballpark 40% down. So if I would have stacked more of this short-term rental, now my portfolio, like stability of income would have been severely impacted. So, you know, I went from like 10K, like for these 4 tiny homes, 10K a month, like almost like 5,000 in peak. So as I'm building my business, I have to figure out, like, I don't want to get too one way to where I get in trouble. Cause like, you know, now that I'm out, I never want to go back. And so stability of income is becoming more and more important to me. You know, when I was in Amazon, if income was up and down like this, no big deal. I'm just feeding it with my Amazon income. My RSUs can bridge the gap. But nowadays, like, I need income like this, such that I'm not taking any shocks, because I don't want too many negative shocks at one time that would, you know, force me to have to go back into regular W-2 world.
J-O-B. You know, I was, while you were talking, I was thinking of probably almost 25 years ago, I did a brief stint as a financial planner. I had, I've talked about this before, but I had, like, you know, Series 6 and 63 and insurance licenses and all that. And when I would go out on appointments with people, basically you do a lot of fact finding. So you find out, like, kind of their risk tolerance, what their current situation is financially, like, what are their goals? And then you basically create a model, and it says, okay, now, leaving real estate out of the picture, because this wasn't on my radar at the time, it's working within the financial markets to identify, okay, based on your goals, what can we design for you as a financial plan that will enable you to retire based on your goals? You'll have enough money. Your risk is set appropriately with the type of assets that you're invested in and all that, right? So you spend time on it, right? Like, you tell me, like, hey, I'm about, you know, like, I'm kind of risk averse. I'm about a 5 on the scale of 1 to 10 with how much risk I'm willing to endure. If I logged into my account and over the last month I lost 10% of my value, I'd probably go throw myself off a bridge. Then as a financial planner, you know that you probably don't want to put them in, like, tech stocks, right? So it's kind of the asking the right questions, building a plan, putting that plan in place, and so forth. And with real estate, I kind of feel like, you know, we just talked about Turo, and we talked about short-term rentals, and we talked about market disruptors. So you have short-term rentals, Airbnb, and VRBO, and those businesses that basically entered the hospitality space. And they made the barrier of entry very, very low. So you as a consumer could say, buy your neighbor's property and operate it as a bed and breakfast. And you have an online portal that's kind of ready to go, and it has all the infrastructure in place. Now, that is a threat, an existential threat to the hospitality industry. And they are, like, Turo, you mentioned kind of the car rental places. They didn't necessarily band together, but they all saw the writing on the wall with that. And they said, okay, we are now going to punch back. So if you have an industry disruptor that you're investing in, you just need to recognize the amount of risk that you're taking on with a David versus Goliath type of a scenario, right? So I think it's, if you use, and I always taught, like, well, not taught, but whenever I was doing financial planning, you take care of the bottom levels of your pyramid first. And those are like, you know, shelter, insurance, savings, and then you get more into the riskier aspects of it. So like, then you get into long-term investments like retirement, then you get into kids' college savings plans, and then you get into, you know, all these things. And then maybe at the very top of that is like your speculative stuff. So say it's like Bitcoin or like, you know, tech stocks or stuff like that, where it's almost like gambling money more or less. And it doesn't really matter if you lose it in the grand scheme of things, because you have your bottom of your pyramid taken care of. And I'm bringing this up because I think people a lot of times might trend or tend to be attracted to the sexy thing that has the wild potential for killing it, like short-term rentals, like Turo, like, you know, these other industry threatening, you know, businesses, where at the whim of lobbyists and people that are so invested in that and have been for a long time, they could just decide to rub you out as a participant in the market. So I guess my point to all that is, like, I like what you're doing, and you have a multifaceted approach to this. I mean, you're doing parking lots, tiny homes, Turo, long-term investments, multifamily, single family. I mean, you're doing a lot of different stuff and diversifying. You're not putting all of your eggs in an industry threatening tech that could get wiped out at the whim of politicians or lobbyists or, you know, companies that band together. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just think that's interesting. And it's worth noting that you have to have your feet under you before you start taking swings at these, like, you know, moonshots.
Right. I think you hit on something that I talk about a lot usually with people when I'm doing speaking engagements, because you're talking about threats and risk. And, you know, for me, the way I look at risk is an evolution. You know, when I was at Amazon and I wanted to get out, people were like, isn't it so risky to buy these out-of-state rentals? And then I would always flip that around to the other side. Isn't it risky if I don't buy it and I'm still here, right? So I'm changing the way I look at things so such that they change. And so, like, I was, like, all in, going as much risk as possible, you know, risk on positions, because I always knew that I'd still be at Amazon if I did nothing. So I'd rather take my shot and get out. Now, fast forward to today, my risk tolerance level is not as high. When you were talking about your foundations, right? You know, what I'm trying to build for my end game, I've got to manage liquidity, and I've got to manage my debt horizon and debt load. So you talk about insurance, you might know, I do a lot of what's called infinite banking concept. So I use whole life insurance policies to build up cash value. The end game of that is simplistically such that I can become my own bank. I'm borrowing money from myself and paying it back such that I don't have to work with banks if I don't want to. That's like my end game. So I'm doing that. The other thing that I'm doing is, when I was mass accumulating all these properties, you know, it was like super simple. I was doing all these with US Bank, and I'd go meet my banker and I'd sign three times and I'd have a commercial loan, you know, and the stack of papers was like 10 pages. And I was getting all these commercial loans. Now, commercial loans, for those people never had one, they're not 30-year fixed. These are 5-year fixed loans, right? So in 2021, rates were amazing, right? Everyone, we'll probably never see them again. I re-levered majority of my debt, and most of my debt is in 5-year commercial. I have a big debt wall coming in 2026. You're talking about existential threats. Jerome Powell is my threat. So in 23, in 24, and in 25, I am consciously selling my commercial loan properties. These are generally 2 to 4 unit properties, selling these 4 greens, getting 1 red, selling the commercial loans. And then I'm getting into seller finance creative deals, i.e. non-bank, with longer fixed periods, lower interest rate, to blend out my length of debt and my average interest rate. So this is how I'm managing everything, because like I never want to be too into one thing. Everything I do is small micro bets to never take down the mothership.
Dude, that was so good. Good. Hey, that was great soundbite there. And I have, I was to kind of dovetail on what you were saying. I was looking at I had a commercial loan bank statement that I was looking at this weekend randomly. It like blew into my neighbor's yard out of my, I was like, what? He came up and handed it. And I was like, what, why do you have this? And he's like, oh, I'm under some snow in my yard. I'm like, okay. So I opened it up, look at it, just make sure it was something important. And I happened to like, I never really pay attention to those that much, but I was looking at it and I was like, it was a $1.875 million property that I bought in Omaha. It'll be 3 years in July, and it was a 5 year fixed, balloon note. It'll reset at, after 5 years, amortized over, I think 25 years. Great debt, 3.5% interest. So my payment on that, and it was, I think 80% LTV or whatever. My payment on it was like, it's like $6,000, maybe like $6,200, something like that. And I was looking at the principal versus interest, and it was like half and half. And this is only my third year of ownership on the property. And I was like, wow, my God, like, I wish I could just extend this thing out like to infinite. You know what I mean? 3.5%, that kind of debt, that kind of principal pay down. We're never going to see it again. I just don't see a pathway for us. And if we do see it again, things are going to be so bad in the economy that is allowing the Fed to lower rates to that level that it's going to, offset everything else. Because, yeah, we might be fortunate enough to refinance at that rate, but stuff's going really bad in other aspects of life. But I love what you said there about Jerome Powell being the existential threat. And he really is. In our world of resetting debt, especially when you get into commercial loans, you're not locked in for 30 years. It's 5 years. Maybe if you're fortunate enough to get, non-recourse Fannie Freddie debt, you can fix it for longer rates, but you're paying a little bit more for those. Yeah. It's just, you got to keep your eye on this stuff. It's just ever changing. Yeah. So, yeah.
And you can't do it. So for me, it's in, it's summerish of 26,
but yeah, that's the day for you.
Yeah, but you have to start doing stuff now, because like the last thing you want to do is sell all your properties in summer of 26 when everybody else has to, right? So like, what I'm trying to do is figure out how do I lower the interest rate and how do I extend that term. And a great one, that one I bought in Des Moines, Iowa, that one is at, the effective net rate is like 3%. And my commercial debt was in the 3.5. So my debt went down from 3.5 to 3. And instead of having like 3 years left, the majority of that, I think I have 8 years. So I got 5 years on the back end and 0.5% lower. And my total value of real estate went up. And so these are like how I'm trying to structurally change things so that, I'm still in the game, right? I'm too lopsided into commercial debt. I know that's my number one risk. So I'm working from today to 26 to ensure that if everything remains the same, that I am still going to be in the game come summer of 2026.
Interest rates are going to be the sole reason that the market gets flooded with multifamilies here over the next couple of years.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. That, well, yes, that. And then you also have the, I don't know what the trillion number is, but all the office assets that are going to be aged, their loans are going to reset. They're coming up on, and, they're going to have to take huge write downs. Like some of these, commercial lenders on these things. I mean, something is going to happen from a legislation perspective to lessen the impact of what is actually happening, which is almost like Armageddon for office.
I was just watching 60 Minutes the other day, and I mean, don't quote me on this number, but I thought they said that there was the equivalent to 11 Empire State Buildings worth of vacant commercial buildings in New York City alone.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I'm surprised it's that little. I mean, as far as like, I mean, there's what's the population in New York? I mean, it's, what is it, 16 million?
Like, I mean, that was for them. They said that was a catastrophic number.
Yeah. It's not going to be good.
Like the bank's portfolios were heavy on commercial mm-hmm. buildings, specifically in that area, but nationwide it is. And they're talking about how they're trying to work around the system. And there's now companies, you know, obviously trying to come in and turn them into,
conversions. But residential or some other or like storage, but whatever.
New York has some stupid rule that only so much square footage can be converted, so they are having like to put these like hollow centers in the middle of the building.
So stupid. They're gonna come, but mark my words, man, they're gonna come out with all kinds of legislation around this and or change up like banking on what banks are able to do and how banks are going to be able to, you know, treat their commercial loan customers, because they're not going to just foreclose on, you know, $1.5 trillion worth of assets but in the office space.
But people are giving them back. When they interviewed one guy, he's like, yeah, I have $300 million into this. We just walked away from it because it made more sense to walk away from it than to try to do something with it.
Yeah, you got to do a cash-in refi. You got to give more to the bank, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I have friends that are going through this right now with stuff they have going on in other states, where they're having to come to the table, and then the bank's like, yeah, thanks for all that, but like that's not going toward the loan. That's just like, well, thank you, because you know you're going to need it, because your asset's now worth 20 to 30% less than it was based on, you know, rents and expenses increasing.